Welcome to the Centre for Army Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Lieutenant Colonel Dean Canham, heading up the British Army's Centre of Excellence for Leadership. In this episode, I talk to Brigadier Jaish Mahan, who commissioned into the Royal Army Medical Corps in 1994 and has served in roles spanning the medical profession. He has deployed on seven operational tours, including Kosovo, Sierra Leone, the Iraq War, and Afghanistan three times. Brigadier Mahan has been a reservist since his transfer from the Regular Army in 2016, and was Deputy Commander Reserves, 7th Light Mechanized Brigade Combat Team, before taking up his current position as Deputy Commander Reserves, 1st UK Division. Brigadier, thank you for joining us. It's a real privilege to have you in. I know you're very busy, but it's a conversation we've really been looking forward to having with you. We tend to start off with asking our guests what leadership means to them personally.
Well, thank you for having me, Dean. It's a real honour to be here and to be on the podcast. In terms of leadership, well, to start with, first and foremost, I think any leadership position is a real privilege. And I believe very strongly in the serve to lead model. I mean, we're sitting here in the grounds of Santa, so I think that's quite appropriate. But I do honestly believe that. And for me, leadership is about being able to pull together a team, getting the best out of that team, and being able to make a difference.
And do you consider yourself as a particular type of leader, or have people told you that you're a particular type of leader?
So I suppose I'd reflect on my last 360 degree and some of the comments from there. So I like to think of myself as a leader that's dynamic, committed. I hope I'm compassionate, trustworthy, as some of the comments that have been put in. Apparently, I'm a good communicator. Yeah, those are sort of the key traits that I would describe myself as, and I have been described as.
Do you think that those positive traits that you've described are things which you've developed relatively recently, or can you trace all the way back to childhood, home, as to starting to develop those types of skills for you?
So I think some of those are born of my personality, and I think other bits have definitely developed over time. So if I look back in terms of childhood, early influences, my parents separated at an early age, so I was brought up by my mother, who a very strong leadership role model, someone who was very dynamic and was very keen to make a difference, do different things, and encourage me to find my sort of niche, my areas that I wanted to get involved with. And then subsequently into school, I was very fortunate to be at a boarding school from 11 onwards. I really enjoyed it, had a fantastic time, and it gave me a lot of opportunities to do different things. Had some great friends. The school encouraged us to thrive in different ways. I got involved with the cadets at that point. And coming from a non-military family, that was something I really enjoyed. And if it hadn't been for that experience, I wouldn't have come into the army.
Yeah, mine was a non-military family as well. And I joined the cadets at school and took the option on a Wednesday afternoon to go and have a look at the cadets rather than go to maths. And I often reflect still now that perhaps I should have gone to maths at some point. When you find yourself in those really difficult, sticky situations, and thinking maths might have taken me down a different path. But overall, I'm very pleased that I did go and have a look at cadets that day. It's absolutely got me to the point where I am today. I can draw a straight line between that Wednesday afternoon and being here now.
Indeed.
Did you think there is a particular character trait or skill that you recognise as being the preeminent one for good or great leadership?
So I would probably say that was integrity and being trustworthy. Because I think if I reflect on the times when I've had the most effective leaders, it's been those individuals that I trust. You know, I trust them in terms of their competence, the fact that they are committed to what's going on, that they actually believe in us as individuals, and they have my well-being in their concern as well. So I think trust is fundamental to being an effective leader. So integrity and being trustworthy.
Yeah, and you served 22 years as a regular officer, and then you transferred to the reserve in 2016. You did a wide variety of medical roles across numerous operational tours in Kosovo, Sierra Leone, Iraq, and Afghanistan. There must have been a vast array of leadership challenges and experiences that you've had across all those experiences. One or two moments of operational leadership that you think have been really formative in your development?
So definitely, I do believe very strongly that every day is a school day, and I've learned a lot from a variety of different operational tours. If I was to share one anecdote, on the route into Afghanistan, as I was pulling together my team to do the final tour, so we were going to be the command team for the medical group, one of our local NHS trusts offered us an away day and an opportunity to do some personality testing, some Myers-Briggs. And I thought this would be quite good fun. So I took my team over, so myself and then the next layer of sort of leadership management along. And it was really interesting during that. It became very clear that I was an extrovert, not really a surprise to myself, but actually a lot of the rest of my team were introverts. And that was quite important for me because it sort of explained some of the frictions I'd been noticing. So, you know, I'm the sort of person that, you know, if we've got a space this afternoon, I'll bring a meeting forward by a couple of days. We'll sit in that meeting. And then I suddenly realized that no one else was really contributing. And that's because introverts didn't have the chance to prepare for that meeting. It had come, you know, completely out the blue. So the lesson I learned was that actually, as a leader, I had to change the way that I did business to get the best out of my team. And that might be something that we come back to later. I think, you know, the personality diversity, we as leaders need to be able to facilitate that in order to get the best out, to get the cognitive diversity going across the team.
And do you think you could look back and pinpoint a particular moment in your career where you really felt that your personal leadership had a really positive effect on a situation or some of your troops? And lots of people sat here doing these podcasts tend to be very modest, but we try to encourage them not to be. And you know, there will be something that hopefully sticks in your mind that you, where you think that was me being my best self.
So I'll go back to Afghanistan. And to set the context, you know, I had done a couple of previous tours where I've been quite far forward. This particular tour, we were based in Camp Bastion. And before I went out, I remember speaking to a colleague of mine who turned around. He had done several tours in Camp Bastion. And he turned around and said, wherever you are in a tour, there will always be some bad days. Not every day will be a bad day, but there'll be some bad days. But just be aware and just spare a thought for the hospital at Camp Bastion that gets everyone's bad days. So that's the context. And I didn't really understand what that meant until probably about halfway through our tour. We had one of those really bad days in terms of from the word go, we had casualties come in. And at that point, the trauma care in Afghanistan had evolved to a really high level. So actually, if you'd got to Camp Bastion, you usually survived. And the first patient of the day actually sadly passed away. And that had a hugely negative effect on the team because people didn't expect that to happen. And I remember having to break the bad news to the individual's commanding officer and the command team. And that was a very emotionally charged time. And then we just had casualty after casualty after casualty during that day. And it didn't really let up till probably sort of late afternoon. And I remember going into the emergency department and they were doing an after action review, a pause of, you know, what had happened. And just looking across the faces, you know, some people were quite upset and I could see some old hands were thinking, oh, no, here we go again to maybe some of the really kinetic, busy times that we'd had before. And others who were on their first tour were thinking, what on earth just happened? And I remember turning around and saying to them, it's been a pretty horrific, horrendous day. But we need to hold the line, and we need to hold the line because there are men and women on the ground that are relying on us, and you know, we owe it to them. And it wasn't what I said, it wasn't, you know, particular phrases or anything, but I did notice that heads came up, people did sort of probably dust themselves off and re-engaged and got going again. And I reflected on that thinking, you know, why did that happen? And I think that's probably because of the relationship that we'd had, the journey that we've gone through, the way that I had got to know the team. And so if I was to reflect, that was probably the most tangible moment of leadership across my military career.
Yeah, I had a linked experience where I was a company commander who, you know, one of my soldiers, early in our tour, very seriously injured, a triple amputee, having trodden an IED. And my first instinct, what I actually did, was jump on the first helicopter that was passing, going to Bastion, and found my way to the hospital to track him down. And myself and the company sergeant major did that almost immediately. And of course, he was heavily sedated and was going to stay that way until he got back to hospital in Birmingham. And actually, we weren't really much use there at all. We should have trusted the medical staff and the system to look after him, which is what they were doing excellently. And we actually just found ourselves displaced from the rest of the company, which we had left behind, which is where we should have actually been, keeping them motivated, planning for the next operation and making sure that their immediate needs and welfare in the aftermath of seeing one of their friends really badly hurt were being looked after. Really sadly, but hopefully an indication of learning quickly, the same thing happened 6 days later.
Oh,
and that moment of leadership where you have to take a quick look at yourself, realise everyone's looking at you, this is the time
Absolutely.
Where you step up. That very cinematic, cliched leadership moment, everything slows down, everyone's looking at you, what do we do now? That's my time. And you make a difference to people and you push on. So I can recognise it from a slightly different perspective in the same scenario.
And I know, you know, and it was a very, you know, it's not a situation where we were under fire or anything like that at that moment in time. But it is, yeah, as you say, it's how the team's reacting. It's when people do look to you at that moment. And you know, that's when you can make a difference. And it's usually when you're not expecting to.
And I'll take the opportunity for all those of us that are out there in those sorts of roles to say thank you to you and all the medical staff that were there in the hospital at the time, because it was an amazing facility that, as you say, kept the vast majority of people alive once they got there. And it did make a difference to the attitude and approach that we were able to deploy out on the ground on all those patrols all the time. You found yourself closing down the hospital for the last time as well. To the untrained, inexperienced eye, it's lots of rows of tents and ISO containers sat in the desert. But obviously, because of the emotional history, the aspects of some of people's best and worst days happening there over a number of years, was that a clinical procedure to close it down, or was it very much a leadership challenge as well?
I know, it was definitely a leadership challenge, I think. We were very much aware of the fact that we were standing on the shoulders of giants when we got out there. You know, it's the way trauma care had evolved over that period of time was just incredible. And so that definitely weighed on us going into that theatre, that actually we had to maintain that highest standard to the end. It's what the men and women who put themselves in harm's way deserve. And that's what we were committed to do. So there was definitely, yeah, a real sense of history as we got to that point. I can, for us at that point, it was definitely the defining military operation of our generation at that point. And we were acutely aware of that. We described ourselves as the final chapter. It was a historical bit that we had a little bit of bomb blast wall that everybody would just decorate. Each team coming through had decorated it for years. And our last one, they decided to call it the final chapter. And they, you know, put up the different badges of the different countries that were working with us at the time. So we were very much aware of that. And it was a real privilege to bring that final chapter to a close.
Yeah. So, Brigadier, I asked about that moment where you thought you'd had a really positive impact on your team. That was great to hear. Naturally, our listeners would expect me to ask the converse as well and say, yeah, has there been a moment where you think you can reflect that perhaps things didn't go so well personally or for the team you were leading that you would have done differently?
So I think probably one of the lessons that I've learned over time is in that situation, if I reflect on that particular tour, I think we did a really good job internally, the way that we linked with our team and our people, etc. And that bit ran really well. I think what we did learn over the period of time was the way that we interacted with the next level up. So I had a very good relationship with my commander, my boss. That was great. We communicated very well. But I think we missed a trick with maybe not engaging as well as we could with his staff. And not necessarily linking into those stakeholders early. And that's something that, you know, it didn't cause any particular friction, but things could have gone smoother, I think, at the start. But, you know, within a couple of months, we'd learned that. We'd developed those relationships. And I think it's, yeah, that was something that if I said, yeah, we'd do it again better, that's what we would do. We'd engage with the staff a bit earlier and just make sure we had all those linkages and we were developing those relationships early.
Yeah. So you're the first doctor that's become a deputy commander of a combat brigade and then deputy commander of a division, first medic in a non-medical brigadier's post. What do you think it is that's found you trailblazing in those leadership roles?
Gosh, trailblazing is a strong word. I think it's one of the strengths of the army that it is a meritocracy, and I think that's been great. And also the fact that it does embrace a bit of cognitive diversity. So if I reflect on, now I had two brigade commanders when I was a deputy commander at 7th Brigade, and they both made very similar comments that actually, you know, a few eyebrows raised when they were first, you know, well, what's a doc doing in that post? But actually, after a while, both of them saying, you bring something different to the command group, a bit of cognitive diversity, you look at things in a different way. And that's really refreshing. It's not, you know, the cliche, you know, bags of smoke straight up the middle. There's different ways. And actually, the problem set that we have to manage now from the army is you know, complex. It involves engaging a variety of different stakeholders, other governmental departments. Sometimes you're working with charities, NGOs, etc. So I think having someone, you know, that looks at things slightly differently is good. And I always try and build teams like that as well. And, you know, one of the things that I'm quite passionate about is trying to create an environment where we actually allow people to be authentic. And I know authentic is a buzzword, but actually, if we can allow people to be who they are, and that just gets a lot more out of them. But very often, although we build diverse teams, the operating system is still dictated by the leader. So, you know, it can be an extrovert, you know, at pace type individual, then that's the way the team operates. And it doesn't necessarily allow people to be who they are. So I think that's a challenge for us as leaders to be able to facilitate that.
The Centre for Armed Leadership published a doctrine note on followership, which listeners can find if they search for it on any online search engine, the British Army Followership Doctrine Note. And that really labours the point that, of course, everyone in the team is a follower of some sort. There's leaders amongst them some of the time, but everyone is a follower. And actually focusing on getting the best out of all of the individuals in the team, in the same way there are skills, traits and characteristics which you can develop as a leader, then there are skills, traits and characteristics you can develop as a follower and help your followers to develop to make the wider team significantly more impactful.
Absolutely. And I know, you know, the army talks a lot about mission command or empowered delegation, you know, setting somebody the tasks, you give them the ends, you talk about, you know, you provide them the means, but we don't dictate the ways and allow people to do that. Now, that's great. And I think is a fantastic way of allowing people to solve things differently. But it does require the leader to be able to facilitate that, you know, set up that trust, allow people to do things in their own way that may look completely different to the way that you would do them. And I've had that a few times where, you know, you try and practice that empowered delegation and think, oh, I wouldn't quite do it that way, but actually it works out. And, you know, that's been part of the journey. And I think that's something, you know, I've worked for people who have trusted me like that, and I have tried to be like that to my team.
Yeah. You're a serving reservist now, having been a regular for a long time. Do you think that you had to do anything different in leadership terms between the regular army and reserve, or is just a different perspective that you're bringing?
No, I don't think I've had to do anything different. I do think when we talk about different operating models, that's something that the reserves definitely bring to the picture, because reservists by default have worked in different environments, have used different operating systems, have worked with different people in different environments, and bringing that into a military setting is just fantastic. And I think that's something that reservists really, really do bring to the party.
I noticed that you've served, obviously, in Afghanistan, we've discussed, but on some intense counterinsurgency operations in Iraq, but also on medical operations, which have had a significant civilian agency involvement to counter diseases such as Ebola in Sierra Leone and COVID in the UK, notably. What are your reflections on how leadership skills, military leadership skills, I'd imagine, and styles have been applied differently between those sorts of scenarios or the common factors?
So I think if we start with the common factors, I think, you know, you're still talking about building a team, bringing a team together. We're talking about accountability, the ability to manage risk and to make decisions. Those are all key facets of leadership. What I think is important is that the situations are different. And very often, you know, the wrong thing to do would be to come in with a particular leadership model, be that military or whatever, and say, this is the way that we're going to do it, without understanding the situation. And, you know, I can speak a little bit about the medical side of things. The NHS is a complex situation. And, you know, to come in and apply the military model, it needs to be a bit more nuanced than that. So it's taking some time to appreciate the situation, understand what the other factors are, what's actually, you know, what would work, what wouldn't work, listening to people who are doing it and understanding that situation. So it becomes more, well, I think all leadership should be collaborative, but definitely if you find yourself working in a situation that's not your norm, the first thing to do is to try to understand the situation and learn from those around you, and then see what skill sets you have might be able to enhance what's already happening. So enhancing what it's doing, because clearly the individuals that are there are already doing a great job. We just want to see if we can try and improve that at all.
Yeah, I've seen an excellent example of it, and it's in a book called Mission Command and Leadership and Operations, which Centre for Army Leadership is publishing later this year. And it's written by Ash Borum when he was having to set up the Nightingale Hospitals in London during the COVID pandemic. And it's an excellent example of bringing together some of the best bits of military process and leadership and combining it with the civilian world, where in the car park outside where the Nightingale Hospital was going to be built, there was a what we would recognise as a very big military model on the tarmac saying this is what the hospital is going to look like in plans terms. We're going to rehearse the concept of how we're going to build and operate it. And of course, this would have been fairly alien to the medical staff, the engineers, etc., who would be building and operating it. But it brought them all together. Everyone understood the plan, very recognisable from a military perspective. But it was the best blend of the two coming together, and naturally a very successful outcome as far as building a huge hospital in a very short order.
Absolutely. And I know Ash fairly well, and I know it's a fantastic job that he did at that point. And that actually also brings in that point about reservists as well. So if you've got individuals that are already involved in those organisations, I've seen that in other areas where you've had situations where, you know, during the pandemic, you've got individuals that have been given a particular task, whether it's trying to help with fuel movements and things like that. And then suddenly you have someone that actually does that in their other job, that can step forward and say, well, actually, and, you know, speak the language, so to speak, because, you know, each sector has its own language. So, you know, having that constant cross-pollination and being able to tap into different people. Yeah, really good.
You're Deputy Commander of 1st UK Division at the moment. I'd imagine that means you get to go and see lots of soldiers going about their business. What do you think the preeminent challenges are for army leaders at the moment?
So I think one of the key challenges is understanding and connecting with the next generation. So, you know, the youngest generation at the moment, Generation Z. And I have a NATO-facing role. And about a year ago, I had links with some of our officer training corps, so that, you know, these are individuals that are at university who opt to do some military service. And I brought a couple of them over to NATO headquarters to do a workshop for us and talk about Generation Z. And actually, it was enlightening. You know, the first slide they put up was the three of them pulling this whole thing together virtually, because that's just the way they operate. So they didn't actually meet till they got to the airport. So, that was the start. And then just how they are very collaborative in their approach. They're used to flatter organizations, not hierarchical. And it was just a really good insight. And I think for us as senior leaders, it's understanding that next generation, because they are the future. You know, they will shape what is going to come next. So.
Yeah. It will be a Gen Zer who is Chief of the General Staff in 30 years' time.
Absolutely. And we'll be doing things in a completely different way. You know, we will be, very difficult to predict where, what and how, but it'll be exciting. Yep. It'll be a different way of doing things.
Yeah, no doubt. Outside of work, then, you're a keen rower and you race competitively. You also exercise a strong faith too. Do you find that you draw strengths and benefits in your military leadership development from undertaking those other sorts of broader activities?
Definitely. I think I'll take the rowing first. So I used to row a lot at university, had a bit of a gap, and then came back to it in a master's crew as we are now. But rowing is one of those sports that's great. I've got a fantastic squad and we race competitively quite a lot. But rowing is one of those sports, as an individual, it's very difficult to exert yourself. It is very much, it's a team effort. It is more important that you are in sync with the rest of the people in your crew and you're able to balance the boat and that makes the boat go faster than your individual ergometer score, so to speak. So, that's about being in sync with people, understanding the team, trying to pull everybody together to move, an eight or whatever faster, so to speak. The bit about faith, I do have a very strong Christian faith that synergizes very well with the Army's values and standards. I believe very much in a values-based approach to leadership as well. And I think it gives you a really good foundation on which to build things from. The world is a complex place. Problems are difficult. They're very rarely binary. They're not black or white. They tend to be sort of very grey. And I think, whatever sector you're in, being able to work in uncertainty is really important, and having a really good set of values and standards as your foundation is a really good place from which to build.
Yeah, in the lots of conversations I have with other organisations about this sort of stuff, the Army is perhaps unique, certainly rare, in that its values have been the same for 24 years, and they are questioned, rightly so, and tested and checked every now and then. But the answer that generally comes back is that they are and remain a sound foundation on which everything else is built. And you can trace the roots of Army leadership doctrine all the way back. If you strip it all the way back, it goes back to values, standards and behaviours. And if you've got that strong foundation, you've got an absolute baseline that everyone understands, then you can always build from that. And on those days when you have to make really difficult decisions, everyone's operating from the same foundational baseline, you're probably not going to go too far wrong.
Absolutely. I've been asked to talk to different NHS trusts about leadership, etc. And, I had one chief exec. He knew a little bit. He'd worked in the MOD before. And he said, I like defences and the Army's values and standards. How do I bring that into an organisation? And we said, it's quite tricky when you've got a large trust and your induction process is 2 or 3 days. That's quite difficult. The Army has the benefit of training pathways where, you go to your basic training, these values and standards are inculcated into you, and it's then repeated. Whenever you do some leadership training, etc., it's inculcated again and again. And also, it's part of our annual rhythm. We do values and standards lessons every year, etc. And as you say, I think it's fundamental. I think it's really, really useful. I've spoken at CCFs recently, and when I talk to them about values and standards, they get it. And, they turn around and say, actually, that chimes with the way that they would like to see society going. And, I think, as you say, it's a fundamental part of how we should engage with each other as well.
Yeah, and real value in them remaining the same. There will always be views and perspectives of how they could be a bit different. Add one or two, take away one or two, everyone will always have a view. But actually being consistent is something which a lot of other organisations crave, because if the values, those things which should be at the absolute core of an organization, change every time the boss changes over, then they start to lack value because they're not consistent. It's quite difficult for people to keep track of them, and so they just don't. Consistency in them is hugely.
I think that's a really valid point. And actually, no, there are some, the army doesn't have the monopoly on values and standards. There are some fantastic organizations with some great values and standards out there. As you say, those that get the organization to buy into those tend to thrive, because it in itself sets an operating system as to how you expect people to engage and how they should engage with each other.
Yeah. Just circling back slightly to your rowing, we use rowing as an analogy on the Army's leadership model as far as developing individuals, building teams, achieving the task, three interlocking circles, and how you need to average out in the middle, but probably most of the time you're edging into one of those areas rather than the other. Probably developing yourself as an individual so that you can play your part in a team so that on the day of the race you can achieve the task, and accepting that you need to build each of those three things. They're interlocking, but you probably need to do bits of it individually as well. But that you don't just have, you can't just sit in the middle, because then you get very average performance overall. You need to average in the middle to be sustainable, but you need to move through those different phases, those different parts of the model, to be able to really perform at the pinnacle and that 1% of the time during the race or on that really difficult day on operations, whatever it may be.
I completely agree with you. And I'm just picking up on one of those points of self-awareness. I think that's really important. As a leader, as a team member, self-awareness has definitely been part of my leadership journey. And yeah, I once did a workshop where I described them as eagle traits and dragon traits. So, eagle traits are those traits that you have that help the organization fly, helps your teams fly. For me, I tend to be quite enthusiastic. I tend to be quite energetic. Those are things that I bring to the team. But then the flip side are those dragon traits, where those are maybe characteristics that can be quite negative for the team. And for me, sometimes I can be quite impatient and I like to drive things at a pace, but that may not be appropriate all of the time. But being self-aware of those, and that's hopefully something over the years that I do less and less. Mm-hmm. But if I look back to when I was in my 20s, maybe I did more and more of. So I think self-awareness is really important. That sort of, if you're self-aware and you're also able to empower your team to then be able to challenge as well. You were talking about lessons from operations. I've just thought of one. As I try to empower my team around me, my next level, to be able to challenge so that we didn't have a groupthink. Mm-hmm. And on several occasions, I had a fantastic second in command and a quartermaster who'd frequently come to me and say, actually, boss, there's a better way of doing this. I think that might not be the best way. And I would be quite happy to do a 180 and to address it in a completely different way. I didn't feel I lost anything from that. Mm. But I think that goes back to empowerment and, making sure that people feel that they can challenge you.
Yeah. These are all great cues for the sorts of things we're talking about at the Centre for Farm Leadership at the moment. The fact that if you're going to address anything in leadership development, then self-awareness is the first step. Don't look at how you're interacting with other people. Have a very honest conversation with yourself to know what you're good at, know what you're not so good at. Ask the people around you if they agree with your assessment of yourself. Ask those above you and below you as well, and try to get really honest feedback. And then you can identify those things which you need to look at improving and form new good leadership habits on. And if you develop that emotional intelligence to be self-aware, you can then move on to developing social intelligence, using it in interacting with your teams, making people follow you more easily, more efficiently, etc. So that hierarchy of EQ and self-awareness first, followed by social quotient SQ and how you interact with other people next, for us comes over and above the IQ bit, the skills and actions which can be taught relatively easily if you've got a good foundation of EQ and SQ in place first.
I couldn't agree more. I think that emotional intelligence is what I think people would expect of leaders as well, in terms of just being able to to understand themselves, as you say, and also to understand the context of each individual as well, because, you know, people have different things going on in their lives at different points. And, you know, that's quite, you know, I have seen certain models where people have talked about, you know, being able to check in and check out, etc. And, you know, just trying to create that environment, if you're going to have a high performance team where you actually have that honesty, you have that trust to be able to turn up and say, hey, I'm here, but actually I'm not having a good day. You know, that's fantastic if you can get to that point. And, you know, I go back to the rowing analogy that actually it's, you know, I contrast rowing when I was a 20-year-old and rowing when I'm, you know, a bit older now. It's coming up to 50. But if you were potentially having a bad day in your 20s or you didn't feel, you wouldn't say anything. Whereas, you know, in our crew now, you know, sometimes somebody will turn around and say, hey, you know what, my back's not great today. Happy to do this and this, but let's not do some racing starts and stuff or something like that. And, you know, that it's quite nice that it got that honest setting that you can get more out of a team if you can get to that place.
Yeah, you mentioned just then about challenging and challenge culture as well. And you referred to it earlier on as well, when bringing a bit of cognitive diversity and being willing to offer different perspectives. We've found in our conversations that the word challenge in itself can be slightly awkward, especially in a military where we very obviously wear rank literally on our chest, and it's a very hierarchical organisation, and hence the word challenge in itself is adversarial almost. Looking for alternative ways to pitch that, and one that we've come up with is a culture of offering. So it's not okay. Challenge, it's I want you to offer your views. I will listen to them as a leader, and I may or may not agree with them. I'll tell you why or why I don't. But I don't know if there's any examples you can find of where challenging has been done really well, even though people might not have recognised it as a specific challenge, whether there's particular nuance or anything to it that you saw was effective.
Well, I think there have been some times where I've turned around and said, actually, we're going to approach a task in a particular way. And, you know, that's the way that we should do it. I think we were looking at drawing down Camp Bastion and, you know, the approach to equipment, etc. And then having somebody else who actually knows the problem a lot better than me to be able to turn around and say, boss, that's not going to work. But saying it before we get there rather than halfway through it going, yeah, you know what, I told you it was, you know, but being able to say that's not going to work and having the space for that individual to be able to expand that and say, yeah, okay, but just explain to me why. Yeah. And then bringing those factors in. So actually it becomes the challenge in itself or the offering. It's the start of the conversation. Yeah. And as part of the conversation, you know, if it becomes a conversation, it's more collaborative. You know, it's not my view versus your view. It's you're raising some points. So let's open that up a bit and let's see how we come together with a collaborative solution.
Yeah. And your point about timing is a good one. I use the example of if perhaps we come across naysayers for encouraging a culture of offering views, it's usually because people default to saying, well, you know, you're an army, and at points you're going to ask people to do really difficult things, and that's not the point for them to question. You know, if a section commander is saying to a private soldier, I need you to run over there, burst through that door, throw a grenade in, get back out. Once it's gone off, get in there with your rifle, finish the job. That's not the point at which you would want them to offer a view that is different. That's not the right time and place. But if on the approach, in the plan, moving towards the town or the village or whatever it may be, going through drills, it's like, well, we could do this a different way. That's the time to offer.
Yeah,
it's a challenge, but it doesn't feel like a challenge if you put it in that perspective. And we do need to move to a point where we can teach people how to offer their views and equally teach people how to receive other views. And it's not to say that one will ever be right or wrong, or any, but actually, as you say, collaborating, having the conversation at the right time and place will be really valuable overall.
As you say, it's about setting that culture so you don't have a specifically default model saying this is the way that we do all the time, that actually we are more creative, we can be more reactive, and we learn because we become a learning organisation. Otherwise, if it's right, if we approach this problem in exactly that way, this is the way that we do it every single time, we're going to get pretty much the same result every time, you know, if we're going to improve. And, you know, sometimes that can be uncomfortable for the leader. And the leader, I think, the leader needs to be comfortable in order to do that. So we need to bring our people on to say that actually that is an appropriate way to, you know, it doesn't undermine you as a leader. It actually strengthens you.
Yep.
You know, you are ultimately trying to get the best solution. You know, use people's ideas as best you can. I think it's exciting. And I think that's always going to be a constant. No one leadership situation is the same in my experience. Going back to what I was saying about every day being a school day, bit of a cliche, but you know, I learn something from people all the time. And especially from the NATO side of things, I learn things from other nations all the time as well, different approaches.
We tend to wrap up with a few quickfire questions. So you can be as elaborate or short as you wish. Who's the best leader that you've personally worked with and why?
I would probably say Major General Tim Hodgetts, who I know has spoken before. He's our current Surgeon General. I worked with him much earlier on in his career when I was a very junior captain, and I also worked with him on operations as well. And he was great, inspirational, somebody that always challenged why we do things. So, you know, challenged the dogma. Is there a better way of doing things? And that was great. Very dynamic. And also an individual that would appreciate the team's individual strengths. So always try and put a round peg in a round hole and would encourage people to be themselves. So you know, going back to, you know, we didn't touch on authenticity, but I think authenticity is really important. You know, I don't believe there is a right, wrong way to lead. If you can be authentic to yourself and the way that you want to lead, then actually that's probably the best for your team. So.
Yeah. And if you had the scope of across the rest of the world or back into history, who's the most inspirational leadership character you would pick out?
So that's always, that's a tricky one. I would, you know, I believe in that model of servant leadership. If I look at my faith, my Christian faith, etc., and going back to the biblical example and I suppose Christ and that servant leadership model, which is where it sort of came from, yeah, I think that's definitely an example that I would refer to.
Okay. And is there one particular book, film, podcast that you draw a lot of value from in leadership development?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm chuckling because I would raise Ted Lasso is something that I've seen recently. And I thought that was brilliant. And I noticed the Believe sign that you have just up outside your office. So I thought Ted Lasso was great. It sort of using that vehicle, it touched on some really interesting aspects of leadership, followership, you know, how a team works, etc., and communicated them in a very different way, in a very fresh way, I thought.
Yeah, and we're a big fan at the Centre for Family Leadership of TED as well. And finally, then, looking back, what's the one bit of advice on leadership you would give to a young Second Lieutenant Mahan if you were to speak to him now?
So I would turn around and say, well, be more patient would definitely be one thing. I would stress that experience is as important as ability, because I think, you know, you need to have experienced those different challenges and things. It really helps develop you as an individual. And above all, enjoy the journey.
Mm-hmm. Great. Brigadier, thank you for coming in and speaking to us. It's been fascinating. We've learned a huge amount. And you've managed to queue up loads of conversation points for stuff that the Centre for Armed Leadership thinks is important at the moment as well. So really appreciate it.
Fantastic. Thank you. It's been a real privilege to be here today.
You're welcome. Talking about his leadership experiences, Brigadier Mahan emphasised the importance of consistent and stable values and highlighted integrity as the preeminent one due to the importance of generating trust between leaders and their teams. He spoke about having the ability to recognise when a leadership intervention can be pivotal in changing the dynamic of a team and a situation, and the importance of spending time early on in leadership positions, building working relationships with the teams wider than your own, who will ultimately be able to support yours. Brigadier Mahan also recounted how he had seen the positive power of seeking and using cognitive diversity in teams, and of allowing individuals and teams to find their own way to solutions through empowered delegation, what the Army calls mission command. Being able to relate to and engage with the newest generations in the Army is what Brigadier Mahan believes to be the most pressing leadership challenge of the day. and notes from his experience that while military leadership skills translate well across into civilian circumstances, the context has to be considered, and often the style of delivery will need to reflect it accordingly. I also discussed with Brigadier Mahan the criticality of self-awareness and emotional intelligence in forging a path of leadership development. He described knowing what his eagle and dragon traits were, positive and negative personality traits, and recognizing and managing their impact on a team. If you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast, then please share it with colleagues and friends and add your thoughts to the debate on social media. For more information on British Army Leadership or to get in touch with the team, search for the Centre for Army Leadership website or find us on all your main social media platforms.